So today we're looking at semiotics. Last time I sort of read out a fairly formal kind of lecture, but I'm afraid I haven't got such a lecture this time. So I'm just going to talk through a few ideas and then look at a text and open it up to a broader sort of discussion, really, I thought. So semiotics was all the rage about 20 years ago, I suppose. It's perhaps longer now, 30 years ago. And what is it? It's a study of the conditions for communication. So what is it that makes communication effective, and how do we communicate? And that's semiotics, so it's fairly nothing sort of mysterious about it, really. It comes from the Greek semion, which means sign. And semiotics is the study of signs, or indeed language, in its broadest sense. So it doesn't restrict it to verbal language. It's anything could be any cultural product, or indeed natural phenomenon, could be a semiotic system. So you've got ritual patterns, mating behavior of animals, cultural systems. They're all semiotic systems, in a sense. And lots of people study biology in terms of semiosis as well, primate behavior and that kind of thing. Now, its roots are in Western hermeneutics, and some argue, or Peter Oakes argues, that its origins are in Augustine, St. Augustine. But it mainly came to the fore with the linguist Ferdinand de Saussure. Around 1900, he's writing, I think. He wrote a general course in linguistics, which was published about 1910 or something. I can't remember. Do you know? About 1910, something like that. He says, well, no, he doesn't say, but this is Jonathan Culler, which is a very good introduction to semiotics, Pursuit of Signs, which is an old book now, but it's still very interesting. The semiotician is attempting to make explicit the system, langue, which underlies and makes possible meaningful events, parole. The Saussure is concerned with the system as a functioning totality, or synchronic analysis, not with the historical provenance of its various elements, which is diachronic analysis. So Saussure made a distinction in language between langue and parole. Langue is the total system of language which any utterance assumes, and then parole is the speech that we speak every day. So he was concerned, as a sort of the beginnings of structuralism, he was concerned with mainly with langue, with the system of language, or what he called the synchronic dimension of language, as opposed to the diachronic through time dimension of language. So the long, the parole, the speech, or the line of utterances through time presupposes the structure of the long. And that was his fundamental understanding, really, from which structuralism develops in linguistics and anthropology. But there's a parallel development with Peirce in the States, pragmatist Peirce, who spells semiotic in a funny way with an E and an I. And for him, the entire universe is perfused with signs, if it is not composed entirely of signs, which is a quote from Peirce, quoted from Culler. And he's got a very distinctive and peculiar understanding of semiosis. And he's a difficult thinker and difficult to get your head around, but fundamentally, he understands the relation between symbol, index, and icon, and he maps out these three ideas. So symbol, he says, is an arbitrary sign, which is what Saussure said. Saussure said there's an arbitrary relationship between the signifier and the signified, between the word arbre, larbre, for tree, and the object. There's an arbitrary connection between them. Vriksha is an arbitrary relationship, but according to the Sanskrit grammarians, there isn't. It's an inherent, relationship. Well, Sanskrit is a sacred language, isn't it?
Some say it is arbitrary.
Some say it's arbitrary, do they?
Some say it's just a convention.
The Buddhists probably say it's arbitrary, don't they? A poor theory.
I don't know, actually. Well, some say it's established by God, some say it's established by man.
Right. Yeah. So, but anyway, Saussure probably didn't know about Sanskrit grammar. He may have done a bit. So anyway, Peirce says that symbols are arbitrary, and that words, language, that's that there's an arbitrary relation between the terms and what they signify. And then he identified, separated an index from a symbol, and an index is a signifier connected to what it is, to what it signifies. So, smoke is an index of fire. Well, he must have been, that's his example. He must have been reading Indian philosophy. He must have been.
Not on a hill, though.
Not on a hill, no.
Wasn't he a Sanskritist, Saussure?
Was he? Yeah, he may have been.
Was he a Sanskritist?
Was he a Sanskritist? Ah.
To begin with, yeah.
Ah, so that's interesting. Yeah. There was a lot of those. There was a guy called Bloomfield who was, his brother was a Sanskritist. And he was an important linguist. So a lot of Panini comes into Western linguistics through that route. An icon, which is a signifier that resembles its signified in some way. So a map resembles what it signifies. So indices and icons are what he calls motivated signs. I would have thought even symbols were motivated, really. But anyway,
good intention. Motivated.
I think he means intentional. They're directional. He also could mean a one-to-one correspondence, perhaps. But the important thing about Peirce, in my understanding, is that his thirdness, though, that a sign. What I've taken from Peirce, what I've come away with, is that a sign is always interpreted by a community or by someone. So a sign is a sign of something for some community or for someone. So a symbol always requires an interpretation and so an interpretant. So I think that's quite insightful. But so Saussure, with his dyadic system of sign and signify, didn't have that interpretant dimension which Peirce did. And both of these early structuralists, if you like, or early semioticians, feed into structuralism in the 20th century. And Roland Barthes is a particularly important figure who had this emphasis on the structure of things, and that every act of communication has a sender, a receiver, and a message. That's a basic semiotic structure, if you like. And this basic structure has influence on all other fields of social science, particularly anthropology and literary and cultural studies. So Levi-Strauss writes those great volumes, Mythologies, based on structuralism, binary opposition.
So Bakhtin is a structuralist?
No, I wouldn't call Bakhtin a structuralist. Oh, I got him there as a structuralist. No, yeah, I have, haven't I? Yeah. No, I wouldn't class him as a structuralist. He's a sort of post-structuralist, before post-structuralism, really. Kristeva is a post-structuralist, really. Now, so you've got structuralism in the 60s mainly, particularly with Levi-Strauss in anthropology, Barthes in language and literature, mainly in France, whose precursors are Saussure's linguistics, to some extent Peirce in the States, although his influence was minimal, I think, on structuralism in Europe, and Russian formalism, because Barthes was particularly influenced by the Russian formalists. And the Russian formalists were in the 1910s to 1935, something like that. And they thought you can have the scientific study of language, the scientific study of poetic language. And that if you analyse poetic language, you'll see that it contains its own internal structures and devices which make it effective, which make it an effective communication. And so they wanted to move away from psychological studies that try to look at language and poetry in terms of author's intention or the psychological motives of the author, and also from historical studies which try to locate the sort of Marxist historical studies, which tries to look at them purely in terms of economic and historical context in which a writing is produced, to the actual texts themselves, if you like. And one of the main things that they're important for was the distinction between plot, which is a non-chronological sequence, and story, which is a chronological sequence. So you can see there the beginnings of the long parallel. It's sort of that maps onto a long parallel distinction of Saussure. A plot is synchronic, and story is diachronic. So you need the plot in order to understand the story. And they also said that narratives could be broken down into analysable units or morphemes, which is what Levi-Strauss picks up with his idea of mythemes, that myth can be analysed into these units of meaning. And the main person behind this is Vladimir Propp, that you may have heard of, who writes an important essay, which is the only thing he's famous for, really, is The Morphology of the Folktale in 1928. And in that, he said that you can analyse folktales into these 31 functions, and I think there were 18 magical number, 18 more important functions, and he just the 31 functions. But there are things like there's a hero in folktales, and there's a journey, and the hero leaves on a journey and returns, and the hero is often pursued by enemies and often has helpers, and so he outlines and breaks down all these functions, and each of these functions is a morpheme. It's a not a morpheme, a morpheme.
It's a phoneme.
It's a phoneme. You probably needed morpheme in 1928 Russia, didn't you? So keep going anyway. So, and his essay was very influential on Barthes and also later on Levi-Strauss, who really just took Propp and developed his idea into the analysis of myths. So he wrote that multi-volume thing, Mythologies, which nobody reads anymore, but it's interesting.
Sounds like Joseph Campbell sort of stuff, right?
That's right.
But he just adds some Jung to it.
He adds Jung to it, yeah.
The same sort of...
Yeah.
The archetypes in the story.
Yeah. He psychologizes it, and Propp would reject probably the psychologizing that Joseph Campbell does. Because it's not to do with the psychology or the mind, it's to do with the structure of the text. Now, reacting to the Russian formalists and contemporary of Propp is the very famous Mikhail Bakhtin, who dies in 1975, just 5 years off. It's born the same year as Propp, in fact. I just noticed that. He dies in 75. And he responds to Russian formalism, and he's a terribly important thinker, I think, and he influences the West through Barthes, but mainly through Julia Kristeva. He comes into the West, and he gets translated in the 70s and 80s. So he was lucky to be alive, actually, because he survived the Stalinist purges. He Stalin didn't like him, so he was going to send him to the Gulag, but he had a very serious blood disease, and I don't know, for some reason they took compassion on him. Of course, one of his legs fell off as a result of this blood disease, and the other one was amputated. So they sent him to Kazakhstan to be a school teacher in Kazakhstan. So he survived all the purges, you know, luckily. And he just wrote. He wrote on, you know, handwritten paper. And then during the war, he used to smoke cigarettes all the time that he'd roll himself and drink tea. That's what his bully did, writing his books. And there's an apocryphal story that he ran out of cigarette papers to roll his tobacco, so he used his manuscripts to roll his cigarettes.
His own manuscripts.
His own manuscripts. So we've lost some of his work. Went up in smoke. Including Towards the Philosophy of the Act. We've only got the first part of that. Because he smoked the rest away or something. So that was his first book that he wrote, Towards the Philosophy of the Act. And he's strongly influenced by Neo-Kantianism. And in that book, the fundamental insight is that all acts are unrepeatable. The unrepeatable, unrepeatability of the action, the unrepeatable event of being, he talks about, and that every act has consequences, which you can't determine, which is outside of your control. But every act is answerable. So it's a very sort of ethical kind of philosophy that he develops there, early philosophy. And then he goes on to develop literary criticism, particularly his book on problems in Dostoevsky's Poetics. So the first thing that about his philosophy is unfinalizability. I'm going to talk about his philosophy because he's important for understanding his notions of dialogue, which is potentially important for understanding our way we look at religions. And he's got this idea of unfinalizability. I'm afraid I don't know any Russian, so I'm just relying on the translations. Unfinalizable self. And he's famous for this phrase, no alibi in being. So he wants to get away from the notion of abstract being, in which we can't take refuge or find any comfort in the notion of some abstract notion of being, because there's only particularity. It's kind of almost like who's wandering around here a few hundred, 500 years ago. Duns Scotus kind of thing, you know, ipseity, this, particularity. And so his self is defined by action, and it's different from Husserl's. He rejects the Husserlian I, the transcendental I, because for Bakhtin, the self is constructed purely in relationships, purely in intersubjectivity. There is no I outside of otherness and outside of intersubjectivity, and therefore historical locatability. And all understanding of the world and of ourselves arises in the dialogical encounter of the self and others. For him, I mean, I'm just putting these as like doctrines, but he does put forward arguments. You know, he argues for these ideas, particularly in context of Neo-Kantian German philosophy. And he's particularly interested in language. So he says, language, we're constituted in language. We're constituted of the I, and the self is constituted by language and in language. So how do we look at language? And so he said that the basic unit of language was what he called the utterance. Mm-hmm. It's a bit vague what he means by that, but say a sentence could be that. So it's a flexible category, but the utterance is a fundamental unit and the basis for the analysis of all communication. And an utterance for him is always performed and assumes preceding utterances. So he's predates Searle and who's the other one? Austin by several decades. And this is from Speech Genres and Other Essays. The speaker presupposes not only the existence of the language system he is using, but also, it's a Russian but there, but also the existence of preceding utterances, his own and others, which his given utterance enters into one kind of relation or another, builds on them, polemicizes with them, or simply presumes that they are already known to the listener. Any utterance is a link in a very complexly organized chain of other utterances. This sort of sounds obvious in a sense, but yeah, it's...
I can understand it. I'm delighted to follow what's going on at this point.
Yeah, it's obvious, isn't it?
Is there some link to Gadamer's notion of every statement is an answer to a question?
Yeah. It's exactly the same idea, yeah. I wonder if Gadamer had read Bakhtin. He may have done. He's writing that before Bakhtin was translated, but I don't know if Gadamer knew Russian. Yeah. But he's writing on his own in a vacuum, really, in Kazakhstan. All this stuff's coming out of Bakhtin's head. Every utterance then is filled with other utterances, and also each utterance anticipates a response and is directed. It has the quality of aggressivity. So each utterance has the quality of aggressivity, but also that's the very nature of the human condition. We are answerable. We have the quality of answerability. He's also wrote a very interesting essay on art and answerability, on the relation between art and life, and what that relationship is, and one of the differences that art is not answerable, but life is. We're answerable in life. Anyway, so each utterance is in a social context, and the intonation is important as well as the context. So he writes a wonderful essay on silence. You've got the silence of the forest, which is different from the silence between two friends, or an angry silence. Or another one, somebody says, "Well," and you can't understand what that means except in the particular context in which it occurs. So anyway, he goes on like this. So understanding is deepened by the activity of dialogue. So there was a whole Bakhtin school which developed particularly in his early years before he got kicked out to Kazakhstan, and also later when he returned to St. Petersburg. But there was another character called Voloshinov, which some people thought was the same as Bakhtin, but that was a pseudonym. But some scholars think that it was a different person. I tend to think it's a different person because it's a different kind of language he uses in his book Marxism and the Philosophy of Language. And he writes, "Any true understanding is dialogic in nature. Understanding is to utterance, as one line of dialogue is to the next. Understanding seeks to match the speaker's word with a counterword." So it's basically the same idea, which he probably gets from Bakhtin. But in that book, the Marxism and the Philosophy of Language, this is important because he coins this term, the philosophy of the sign. And it's in that idea of the philosophy of the sign which is becomes a critique of the philosophy of consciousness, of phenomenology, and going back to Kant and Descartes. Now, Bakhtin, another term that he coins is heteroglossia, which is a translation of the Russian, which means other voices. So he emphasizes that other voices in every utterance, there are echoes of other voices. And the literary critic's task is to analyze and understand the other voices inherent within speech. Now, in Voloshinov and also Bakhtin, critiques of Surian linguistics. And in his in that book, Voloshinov offers a materialist interpretation of significational language as a system. So he criticizes Saussure as being idealistic, really. And he rejects the abstract systems of Saussure. And he also rejects romantic individualism. So that it's all about the language is all about longing, or is all about individual expression of my emotions or whatever. No, says Voloshinov, language is set in a particular social context which is constrained by material conditions which we can analyse. And that's the job of the scientist, to analyse that, if you like, to analyse the conditions under which certain particular utterances arise. So he wants to bring us back all the time to the world, to the material construction, constitution of the world. And there's this famous quote from Bakhtin that I hear voices in everything and dialogic relations among them. So Bakhtin hears voices in everything. So it's the whole world for Bakhtin is one of them. He could be mad, of course. The whole world is one of.
What was he smoking?
What was he smoking? Yes. In Kazakhstan. There's a wonderful picture of him with his cigarette and his tea, you know. But he was kept alive by his wife, and she gets no credit for keeping him alive, you know, keeping him going. Filling up his teapot all the time. The world is full of signification and sign systems, and everything every utterance echoes other utterances. It's a bit like kind of Indra's web or something like that. Everything reflects everything else. And to understand the world, which is a system of signs, we need to understand it as in terms of dialogue, that the sign is constructed between socially organized persons and only exists in dialogue. There are no abstract kind of signs, if you like. Signs are always material. And this is a fundamental insight, I think, that Bakhtin had, the material nature of the sign. And I think that's terribly important for our understanding of religions, the emphasis on the material nature of the sign. And dialogism can help us understand the wider social processes. So he wants to avoid causal explanations, and he emphasises, a bit like the German Verstehen tradition, he wants to emphasise Verstehen rather than explanation. So understanding rather than explanation. What is explanation? If explanation is the location of a cause, Bakhtin thinks that that kind of reductionism is inappropriate for social context, for understanding culture and society. And that we have to have Verstehen for that, and dialogism, although he never actually used the word dialogism. So we begin with dialogue and communication, and not with the transcendental ego. We don't begin with consciousness and understanding the world. We begin with systems of signs, and we begin with language, and we begin with the material nature of the sign and the material nature of interconnection between human beings, with body, with body and speech. He developed all these ideas, particularly in the context of literary criticism. And he wrote a wonderful book on Dostoevsky called Dostoevsky's Poetics or something, in which he said there are some writers are monoglossic and some writers are heteroglossic. Monoglossic means just one voice, if you like. But Dostoevsky is a truly heteroglossic writer because all the characters have a life of their own and have other voices. And he develops this idea of the genuine other voiceness of Dostoevsky's writing. So Bakhtin, anyway, he goes back to Moscow and he dies when he's becoming famous in 1975. He escapes the purges and he teaches at the university. But he never sorts out the controversy over the authorship of his early texts. Perhaps he was a bit playful like that, I don't know, but he never did. And he gets introduced to the West by Julia Kristeva, who is... I think she's Croatian, I can't remember, Russian perhaps, who teaches in Paris. And she writes A Revolution in Poetic Language in 1974, which gets translated into English in 1984. And she has an essay on Bakhtin. And so semiotics in the West is strongly influenced by Bakhtin, and also cultural studies as well. Through her work. Now, she herself is a very interesting thinker, and she's influenced by also by psychoanalysis, by structuralism and feminism, although she rejects a lot of structuralism. One of her fundamental distinctions is between the semiotic and the symbolic. And the symbolic assumes are symbolized and is irreducible to this. To the symbolizer. So she is, for example, in medieval France, the symbolic was participatory. So the sacraments were a symbol of God, if you like. When you participated in the sacraments, you're kind of joining in with something beyond yourself, something transcendent. Now that was of its time, but it's a closed system for Kristeva. The religious symbolism is a closed system, so she wants to rather emphasize the notion of a sign as an open system, because there's an arbitrary relationship between the sign and what it signifies, and it's open to generation and transformation. A sign, she says in the Revolution in Poetic Language, is the fundamental ideologeme, they love these emes, ideologeme of modern thought, and the basic element of our discourse. It does not refer to a single unique reality, but evokes a collection of associated images and ideas. Its meaning is the result of interaction with other signs. It contains transformation. New structures are always generated and transformed. Now, to get a hold of some of what she's saying, I thought we'd have a look at her actual one of her early texts, which is in that outline. Has everyone got? Have you got one?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. What page do I start on there?
24.
24. Yeah, let's just have a look at that first paragraph. So, however great the diversity, the irregularity, the disparity, even of current research in semiotics, it is possible to speak of a specifically semiotic discovery. What semiotics has discovered in studying ideologies, myths, rituals, moral codes, arts, etc., as sign systems, is that the law governing, or if one prefers, the major constraint affecting any social practice lies in the fact that it signifies, i.e. that it is articulated like a language. Every social practice, as well as being the object of external, economic, political, etc. determinants, is also determined by a set of signifying rules, by virtue of the fact that there is present an order of language, that this language has a double articulation, signifier, signified, that this duality stands in an arbitrary relation to the referent, and that all social functioning is marked by the split between referent and symbolic, and by the shift from signified to signifier coextensive with it. One may say then that what semiotics had discovered is the fact that there is a general social law, and that this law is the symbolic dimension which is given in language, and that every social practice offers a specific expression of that law. So I thought that was a fairly succinct and condensed understanding of the semiotic of the So, I mean, it's actually probably because it probably wasn't obvious in 1974, but it seems obvious now that we live in systems of signs, and myths, rituals, moral codes, etc., sign systems. So, to order, so as opposed to understanding religion, say, from phenomenology's perspective, from the beginning with notions of consciousness, you could extend this to say that you have to begin with systems of signs rather than consciousness, in order that that's a more appropriate understanding of way to understand human systems of signification. Right, let's Okay, let's carry on with that. This first sentence here. A discovery of this order cut short the speculations characteristic of idealism, which throughout its history had claimed the domain of meaning as subordinate to itself, refusing to allow it both external determination and internal adjustment. What does she mean by that?
So is she a structuralist in that sense?
Yes, she's often classed in that structuralist school, but she's critical of the Saussurean thing. Yes, she's like a discovery of this order, i.e. the discovery of semiotics, cut short the speculations of characteristic of idealism. Why does it do that? I guess because what is idealism?
Is it the result of a philosophy of consciousness?
Yeah.
And this order is actually part of, it's expressed through every social practice.
Yes.
So it is not something which is in someone's mind.
That's what semiotics does. Or do you think you'd... Say it again.
I mean, the previous paragraph, semiotics had discovered, is the fact that there's a general social law.
Yes.
This law is a symbolic dimension which is given in language, that every social practice offers a specific expression of that law.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So idealism was the view that you could understand human reality purely in terms of consciousness.
Yes.
So Fichte and all these people. And this is the discovery of semiotics challenges that view, she says. Marx was a critique of that of the philosophy of consciousness as well. But I don't think he was a semiotician. So the discovery of this order cuts short the speculations characteristic of idealism, Fichte and all the rest of them, which throughout its history has claimed the domain of meaning as subordinate to itself, refusing to allow it both external determination, i.e. through matter, I suppose, and internal adjustment. I'm not quite sure what that means. I guess through consciousness being constructed through language, partly in her view.
So is she talking about idealism as a mental speculation, as opposed to an embodied order of social...
As opposed to an embodied order of social
meaning,
reality. So how can you understand human reality? You can understand it... One way of understanding it was in terms of consciousness. So Fichte talks about I and thou constituted in my consciousness. Or Husserl, I assume there are others over there. I make an inference about you lot over there through my experience of myself as a transcendental ego. And Kristeva says, no, you don't have to do all that. You actually, what's given is not consciousness, but language and systems of signs is the primary reality. Why should we take consciousness as the primary reality? Isn't it more obvious to take socially given systems of signs as the primary reality? Look from where we start. And if we do that, then we get different results.
How about in the case of Peirce's notion of the interpretant being does that also hold true for that? Because that would seem to give some sort of priority to the consciousness.
Oh, that's true. That's a very good point. Peirce. Yeah, he comes back to consciousness, so he must do, because he's got the system of signs. Thirdness is the system of signs interpreted by someone or by community.
So it's both. There's the sign and the consciousness.
Yeah, for Peirce, that's right. It's a very astute observation. Yeah, Now, she doesn't go on about Peirce. But in a sense, culture, I mean, you can have some of these semioticians, like Helms, whatever his name is. Helms, I haven't read him yet, but he's a biologist. Some Scandinavian. Because his name begins with H. Helmslev. Oh, there we are. Helmslev, yeah. I think he's a biologist, anyway. You know, anti-humanism. And he talks about systems of science, but you don't have to have consciousness to understand systems of science. Systems of science carry on without independently of consciousness. So he's not particularly interested in consciousness. Which I guess is true, in a way. The way our bodies work, our body could be a system of science, and that carries on independently of the way, whether we're aware of what's going on or not. So consciousness is overrated in these semiotic thinkers. It's giving an account of the world.
So she's locating semiotics in between idealism and materialism.
Yes, because she's not a full-blown Marxist. Although she's influenced by Marxism. That's right. And she's also strongly influenced by psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysis is concerned with sign systems, she says, but without which are unconscious. So let's get on the next page 26. And yet semiotics, by its attempts to set itself up as a theory of practices using language as its model, restricts the value of its discovery to the field of practices which do no more than subserve the principle of social cohesion, of the social contract. In other words, insofar as linguistics has established itself as the science of an object, language, speech, discourse, so obedient to the necessity for social communication as to be inseparable from sociality, any semiotics which adopts this linguistic model can speak only of those social practices, of those aspects of social practices which subserve such social exchange. The semiotics that records the systematic, systematizing, and informational aspect of signifying practices.
So that alliteration there.
yeah, a lot of alliteration.
She writes in French, right?
Yes. You can tell. And then she goes, it's not difficult to see why its stronger point, i.e. semiotic strong point, should be the study of the rules of kinship myths as examples of community knowledge. So, I mean, arguably then, it's better to understand kinship, better to understand myths and rituals in terms of semiotics than in terms of consciousness or experience. Of course, they're all systems of dress fashion. Like we're wearing shirts or jackets or something. Why is that there? Because it's part of a sign system. Fashion is part of a sign system. And that it's pointless to understand what you're wearing in terms of consciousness, but it makes sense to understand what you're wearing in terms of fashion, in terms of side systems in which we live, or anti-fashion, or whatever. So likewise, I mean, that's perhaps a trivial example, but likewise with kinship systems, and you get structures of kinship, and myths, which Levi-Strauss developed. Structures of myths. So, rather than read out the whole thing, we could raise a question of, by extension, rather than the transcendental ego, as the basis for understanding the world, which comes in perhaps to the study of religion through the Husserlian epoch and so on. Is it not better to understand religions as signified processes and to see them in terms of systems of signification initially, rather than in terms of experience or consciousness? And which leads us into the primacy of the world or the material nature of the sign, rather than the abstractions of consciousness and experience. So Christina is not particularly interested in religion, but she does talk. She does begin to talk about religion a bit later on. But
does she say much about myth?
No, she doesn't. She talks about a lot about psychoanalysis, feminism, she's trying to get it. Actually, she through semiotics, she says we can understand a basic human. She does get back to experience a basic human dimension, which she calls the kora, which is Greek, which I don't know what it means, but I don't know what it refers to. I don't know what the actual Greek word means, but it means the energy or the power of life. She's French. They always go. Well, she's not French, but she's. Well, she writes in French, but they always go on like that. And you know, the élan vital. All those French philosophers that we've read in the phenomenology, they all go on about that.
Sounds a bit like she's kind of putting religious systems in their place with that distinction between semiotics and symbolism.
Mm.
They're saying that that's the medieval way of doing things,
yes.
And this is the constantly changing social contract that
yes.
we should be. But it implies that sacrament doesn't change in terms of social contract as well, though it could always have a kind of textual referent in terms of actual function within a community. There can be plenty of change.
That's true.
Over time, so it can be as much semiotic in her definition as
that's true.
Symbolism.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it must do, otherwise it would die out, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Would die out.
So she's kind of freezing it in time. And
yeah. Pushing it off into the side there, that's right. Yeah. I mean, the sacramental has to be semiotic as well in her terms, otherwise it wouldn't survive through the generation.
It has to always be reinterpreted and changing with each generation.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I'm sure you must have a lot of Catholic theologians who have written on semiotics of the sacrament. I don't know. Have you?
No.
You haven't? No. You haven't? Oh, that's interesting. Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Paul Fiddes, he's a great fan of Christeva. And when he talks about Christeva, it's a terribly lucid expositions he gives. And he translates her work into, he's a Baptist, of course, into Baptist theology. Oh, yeah, we know you. You know Paul. Ask him about Christeva.
I'm a bit unclear about her distinction between the symbol and the sign.
I think the symbol has an inherent relationship to what it symbolizes for her,
whereas the sign is more
is open-ended and arbitrary, and therefore more open to change and transformation. It's better to understand our lives in terms of the sign than the symbol. The symbol ties us in to a sort of old-fashioned hierarchical cosmology, which she would want to reject, in her view.
It is, of course, interesting that in the older catechism they would make a distinction. The distinction was quite clear that certain things are sacraments in which there is, in fact, the sign does what it signifies, and the catechism user is aware that this is very different from other kinds of signs, so it's not exactly a recent discovery, and there's a deliberate insistence that this particular section of things is different from what everybody knows about ordinary communication, the signs and the like.
That's interesting, yeah.
As many Protestants didn't accept that part. They said that is the old Catholic way of doing it. The Catholics said we'll keep both.
Ah, yeah. So in the catechism,
The definition of what a sacrament is, it's a sign that produces the that which it signifies. This isn't exactly the wording, but that was the idea. Mm. So you get the real presence of the body and blood of Christ in the Eucharist. Mm. And most Protestants don't accept that. They stepped on. Catholics deliberately hold on to it, interestingly enough. Mm. Mm. Whatever.
So those are participation.
Good or bad reasons,
it's fundamental, isn't it?
They hang on to it.
But yet as a sacramental meal, it's been part of a constantly changing social contract as well. Like, it was a meal before it became known as Lord's Supper. It was connected with Passover, you know, and so there was kind of, it was that voice responding to a previous voice already, you know, so it was referring to something already. It wasn't just dropped out of the sky and said, here, this will symbolize this now. Mm. So it seems more actually has to do with her semiotics than
with the symbol.
Than the symbolism. Yeah. Yeah. It's almost like a straw man sort of thing.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Just to say semiotics is better.
Yeah. Probably right. Yeah. So the symbolic, her symbolic is a straw man. It actually was never actually like that. Yeah. It's very interesting.
And same thing with baptism. Like, there was these ritual washings, and then this community now found a new meaning for it. Mm. And then that changed over time as well, and you know, introducing infant baptisms. And,
I take it that she's saying if I'm a Catholic today, then for me that is a symbol. And sort of, I may not be aware of the whole history of the whole thing, but for me that now is a symbol, or something else might be a sign because it's sort of in my life it's less fixed, or it's more open, or it's sort of generative for her.
She probably want that.
I mean, is she talking about sort of just a particular instance of something where, I mean, I, as far as I've understood, she means by sign basically something that she's saying that it stands for something else, but that relation is sort of not fixed, so that it can stand for one thing but then for something else as well, and at a different time or for a different person. So if she's looking at it not in sort of diachronically, not sort of looking at the history of the sign, but just as a at the moment, then I suppose it might, her distinction might actually work.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know if that's
I think it's something she goes on about, that sort of thing, on later on in Revolution in Poetic Language. There's a chapter on the semiotic and the symbolic, and her main distinction is the arbitrary relation between the signifier and the signified in the sign. And it has a relation to the extra, what she calls the extra linguistic.
What directions this has been taken in religious studies, or how's this? Is there a particular development?
In study of religions,
or is it just sort of taking bits and pieces from
people? Yeah, it's just taking bits and pieces. You don't get many people developing exceptional, like Paul Fields, developing a kind of theology, developing a Christabian, a semiotic understanding. Somebody like Peter Oakes develops that within Judaism. So you get people in specific theological fields, but as a general theory of religion, there isn't much going on with this.
She seemed to be very popular before I took retirement among women students at the University of Toronto who were concerned with feminism.
Yeah.
It's a feminist critique, and I don't recall many of them talking much about sign and symbol. It was the more political side of what the feminists would be.
Right.
I wasn't directly involved with them, but you have conversations, you read their proposals.
Mm.
The name keeps coming up.
Yeah,
but it doesn't sound too much like this.
Ah, right. Yeah, this is her foundation work in that book, Poetic Revolution, Poetic Language. She is influenced by feminism, and she's influenced by Lacan, and
that's another of the French names that keeps coming up again and again. And one of our colleagues was primarily into psychology and philosophy, the linkage of these, and psychoanalytic psychology, if you will. And the students would typically gravitate around that figure, that colleague, and the Chris Staber things would pop up.
Well, she, one of the reasons why she's against the symbolic is, in a sense, because Lacan used the notion of the symbolic, which he identified with the phallus and with language itself, and that women were therefore excluded from the realm of the linguistic realm of language. And so, but so you try to reclaim that language for women. That's a feminist move that she makes. And that you do that through the notion of sign rather than symbol. So you want to kind of destroy the symbol.
This probably gets into rewriting the Gospels and the rest of the Bible, where you have a very patriarchal kind of language.
Oh, it does. I think it's just say,
this is the sacred text. The getting into the symbolic sense, you cannot change it. And women say, well, the better sense would be if we got rid of he and it's it, or he, she, or parent, or whatever. So these things work their way out in a very practical sense.
That's right, I think, is it Fiorenza or someone? Fiorenza? Fiorenza. So I've got a book called In Memory of Her.
Yes. Her name pops up frequently.
I think she was influenced by Christie.
How about Mary Daly? She was a tough one at the beginning.
And there's another one here. What's her name? I can't remember her name. She's up at your place too. She's a friend of Pamela's. Pamela Anderson, a friend of hers. Not Mary Daly, but it's somebody like Hampson, Daphne Hampson. Post-Christianity. So Chris Staver is in her later work, is particularly on feminism and so on. But her earlier work is on signs and responses to Lacan.
Does she connect semiotics with social practice?
Yeah, she's influenced by the notion of the material nature of the sign. But her writing is fairly abstract on the whole. But she's against the transcendental ego. And she's got lots of diagrams, like, you know, incomprehensible diagrams of mathematics. A's and B's. And she's against monologism, and she takes from Bakhtin the notion of the carnival, carnivalesque. And she's quite into the disrupture of bourgeois culture, bourgeois society. As she writes about literature,
What would a semiotic approach to the study of religion look like? How would this have implications on one's research as a student of religion?
Yeah, that's a good question. Would it look any different from, say, what you do anyway, where you've got texts and you read the texts and so on? I guess it might make a difference. Instead of trawling through Shankara looking for experience, mystical experience, and not finding it, you start somewhere else. You start with his response to the Mimamsaka. I guess it might affect that.
It might also encourage you, if you were, say, primarily doing textual studies, to say, well, the text comes out of a broader set of symbols. What are the ritual symbols going on, and what are the more dominant secular categories of life? So you tend to take each of your more narrow foci and then see them in this broader picture.
That's
that
right.
Would seem to be one of the ways that the semiotic approach, where it might actually have you looking at things other than text and rituals. Of course, people do look at church architecture. That's religious art is done, but you sort of want to look at that in the context of other things. Was it Henry James did this business on Chartres, or one of the James?
Did he?
Or Adams, maybe it was one of the Adams did this interesting thing on Chartres in the context of the totality of the Christian faith and symbolism that comes out in that track.
Well, that would be a semiotic approach. That would answer to your question there. Very interesting.
Well, perhaps not being able to really understand text until you see how it's performed.
Yeah.
Like text can't just be read on its own with a bunch of commentaries, but it has to look like something in a community and paying primary attention to that. Or at least at the very end, getting around to doing that, if not starting there.
Yeah. And seeing that as a system in itself, you know, an interrelation. Yeah. Each element relates to other elements and so on.
Mm-hmm. Wilfred Smith encourages people to be aware of how a text is recited, whether it's sung or preached or whatever, and then that broadens out into the whole ritual context in which it's used. Excuse me, you had something.
Oh no, sorry. But how about those texts that sort of the authors claim that this is from an experience? This is what gave birth to the text. How would a semiotician approach?
I don't know. I think a semiotician would say that you've got the text, which is part of a network of texts, and it's an utterance which corresponds to other utterances. And it's impossible to determine what the relationship between the inner experience of the person who wrote it is and the text itself, I suppose. I don't know.
Semiotics is a quest for meaning again, isn't it?
Yeah, a quest for meaning.
As opposed to how phenomenology would provide meaning through how phenomena presents itself to the consciousness, or opposed to a materialist reading where we look at the underlying powers that determine a phenomena. Mm-hmm. So here we are saying that meaning is accessed by looking at the narrative or the network of signs.
Yeah.
Within which the text gains its meaning.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. That's the fundamental difference. I think that's right.
Of course, it does.
That's part of your book in Beyond Paris.
You didn't say that's all.
I thought that sounds really good.
You wrote it.
He's hoping you refute that.
That's a load of nonsense.
A lot depends on whether you are a semiotic reductionist.
Yeah.
Semiotic reductionist says the only thing you want to look at is what you can see in the suit. So I, taking a simple-minded counterexample, say my wife or somebody sends a note and says, I love you. Well, the semiotician will look and see what love means and all of this stuff, and he will give it his estimate. I'm concerned whether there is someone out there who actually does love me, or someone writes a hate letter of some sort. Do I have to protect myself?
How do I?
And I think if someone comes out of the Vaishnavite kirtan and said, I've had a wonderful experience of devotion. If you like semiotics to some extent, you will look at all of these different symbolic elements that will get you a better sense as to what kind of devotional experience this lad or lassie might have had. If you are a pure reductionist semiotics person, you're not really interested in it. You'd like to see how this kind of devotion relates to Sikhs or some other strange type of human being, Christians.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Yeah, the semiotician might look at that experience and does it echo Rupa Goswami or something like that?
Well, it's a wonderful thing to do. You don't have to be a reductionist. It's sort of like somebody who wants to read Rupa Goswami, and it helps to know Sanskrit. Mm. If you don't know Sanskrit, it's sort of hard to know what Rupa might have said. Mm. But it's still a question. Do you want to know what Rupa said, or do you just want to know what the Sanskrit is? Mm. Depends how you use the semiotics.
A lot of these semioticians do. I mean, in their rejection of consciousness, that is problematic too, because we are conscious beings. We're sitting on a table. We're using language. We're aware of our intentions and what we want to do, and all the rest of it. So to go too far and reject that out of hand seems to be also in error.
Mm-hmm. We live in massive errors. The more of these things we learn, we discover them.
Yeah,
we're erroneous all the time.
Yeah. I remember speaking to someone about 10, perhaps 8 years ago now, who was D'Aquili. Do you ever come across him? D'Aquili. He wrote a book, Spectrum of Ritual. He was he was a semiotician, really, but he was interested in brains and brain chemistry and all that sort of thing, and cognition, and seeing Richard in terms of brain chemistry. I can't remember, but I said something to him, something like it was, when you did that kind of study, you weren't aware of the cultural assumptions or presuppositions of on which you were basing it. And he said, yes, but we didn't know that then. He said, I thought, very wise. You know? Yeah, so these things develop. So I do have faith there's progress in knowledge.